Welcome to the Sunstone Podcast, everyone. I'm your host for this week, Stephen Carter. How are things going with you? They've been just a little bit weird with me, to tell you the truth. On Wednesday, January 6th, my brother, who works in Washington, D.C., texted me and said, "Things are going a little nuts at the Capitol." So, being the good citizen I am, I checked the New York Times app on my phone because, yes, I pay for my news. I'm kind of old school that way. And I saw exactly what you know I saw. The next thing I did was to check my Wall Street Journal app because, well, I try to triangulate between left and right-leaning news sources. I'm kind of old school that way. And saw the same thing. And strangely enough, the first thing I said to myself was, "Boy, it sure is strange being Mormon these days." To which I replied, "Wait, what do I mean? This is about national politics, not Mormonism." But I looked at me smugly and raised an eyebrow. "Go ahead and figure it out," I said. So I read the news, I read opinion pieces, I assiduously avoided social media, and I took a lot of walks, which is where I do my best thinking while working off a few calories so I can dig a little bit further into my Christmas candy stash. And I finally figured out what I meant. Mormonism and Donaldism are the same kind of organism. I know, the larger world prefers the word Trumpism, but that just doesn't have the right ring for me. Donaldism feels so much more appropriate. That they're the same kind of organism may sound strange, especially since Donald's most vocal Republican critic is Mitt Romney, who recently won the title of Mormon poster child from Donny Osmond in a cage match, even though Donny is 10 years younger. But the more I thought about it, the more freaky and wide-ranging the similarities became. Starting with the context they each grew up in, which I think can be summarized in two phrases: partisan conflict and conspiracy shift. But of course, the partisan conflict that I'm talking about wasn't political, it was religious. You remember that Joseph Smith lived during the Second Great Awakening, and the religious landscape then looked a lot like the political landscape looks now. The various denominations were vying hard for the souls of the populace, and the choices people made about which church they joined didn't just affect which building they went to on Sunday. It affected their families and their reputation, the same way that your political party affects people now. Remember that in the Joseph Smith history that's printed in the Pearl of Great Price, Smith does write, quote, "Great multitudes united themselves to the different religious parties, which created no small stir and division among the people. The Presbyterians were most decided against the Baptists and the Methodists, and used all the powers of both reason and sophistry to prove their errors. On the other hand, the Baptists and the Methodists, in turn, were equally zealous in endeavoring to establish their own tenets and disprove all others." Unquote. Does that sound familiar to you? And the interesting thing about the traveling preachers who led the revivals that fueled the Second Great Awakening is that they were valued not for their knowledge of the Bible or Christian church history, but for their charisma. Their job was to whip people into a religious frenzy. The better they could do that, the more demand they created for themselves. In other words, their job wasn't to gather evidence to support their claims and present their listeners with a sound argument. It was to infuse their ideas with as much emotion and drama as possible. Once again, sound familiar? And then there was the newspaper scene. Back then, at least in populated areas, you started a newspaper not to inform the populace of the latest goings-on about town, but to push an agenda. You started a newspaper specifically to, like, promote workers' rights, or women's suffrage or abolitionism. You weren't aiming at a general audience. You were actually bringing people together under a particular flag. Which, again, sounds pretty familiar. You have to know what kind of salt to add to any news source you're reading or watching today. Unless, of course, you like the way they season their news and wouldn't have it any other way. But we, being the lucky civilization we are, have an extra layer of partisan conflict. See, it used to be that freedom of the press belonged to those rich enough to have a press. But everything changed once the internet came along. Now, everyone has a press, and the way you build an audience is not through objective reporting of the information, but by using a particular worldview to decide which information is important and how to interpret it. And then we get the extra layer of Facebook groups and, you know, other message boards where there isn't even a veneer of objectivity because it doesn't pretend to be a news source. People come specifically for the agenda. Information is accepted, rejected, and molded according to the guiding worldview of the group. And of course, this applies to everyone, on all places on the political slash religious spectrum. It's not that the right does it and the left doesn't. Everybody does it. It's our tribal instinct. I mean, think about the online groups you interact with. It's very likely that you interact with them not because of their moderate presentation of information, but because of their worldview. I mean, why do you listen to me? Yeah, I'm asking both of you. You come here because you know we'll be taking a pluralistic look at Mormonism and how it interacts with the rest of the world. It's not going to be a devotional. It's not going to be an attack. It's not going to be even a moderate presentation of information. You're here for the worldview. But being the lucky civilization we are, we have an extra intensifier of partisan conflict that wasn't even around during the Second Great Awakening. During the early 1800s, you had to physically go to a religious revival. You looked around, you saw who was there, you listened to the preacher, and then you went home to tell everybody about what you saw and heard. In other words, these revivals occurred in physical spaces that everyone had access to. And it took time to set up and run a revival. You advertised for them. You wanted a lot of people to be there. So, they were public events. And news of what happened there got around the community, and therefore became part of public discourse. This is in stark contrast to our current state of discourse development. Nowadays, probably 95% of discussion happens online, and there is a lot of discussion about a lot of topics in a lot of virtual spaces. And what this means is that the various discourses on various issues are going in fast-forward mode. We don't have to wait for a year to go to a conference on our particular subject. We don't have to wait for the monthly magazine. We don't have to wait for the weekly radio program. In fact, we don't even have to be listeners or readers only. We can get onto the discussion board or onto the comments section and add our 2 cents right now and as often as we want. With all this activity, the larger discussions quickly splinter off into smaller discussions that grow until they splinter off into smaller discussions that grow until they splinter off and on and on. And each of these discussions, slowly or quickly, make their way toward becoming grown-up discourses of their own. They start defining themselves. They gather material. They develop arguments. They forge a worldview. And they attract and attack opponents. Until they become large enough, with enough material and enough contributors, that they suddenly break into public discourse, to the surprise of everyone. I'm sure that something like this has happened to you recently. You're just scrolling happily through your social media feed when suddenly you stumble across one of your friends saying something that seems completely outside the discourse you thought you shared with them. You know, it can happen in any number of ways, from them identifying with a philosophy that you had thought of as fringe, or believing things that your discourse community has dismissed as false, or maybe they take a particular ideological ball and they start running with it in a completely different direction. And at first, you're shocked. You feel like you suddenly don't know who they are anymore, like they've turned into a Mormon all of a sudden. But then you think, they just missed this particular fact or this particular idea. I just need to tell them about it, and they'll come happily back to the discourse community we once shared. So, you contact them, and you start to talk. And the more you talk, the more you realize that the weird thing they wrote on their social media feed is just the tip of the iceberg. You realize that they didn't come to this opinion over, like, the past few days, but that they've been ascending this mountain of information for the past few months or years, and that anything they say comes from somewhere on that mountain. And that you didn't even know that mountain existed until now. That is what the internet has done to public discourse. It's a space where millions of mountains of information grow up without anyone knowing it. Except the people who are making those mountains. And then, when the top of the mountain suddenly breaks into the larger public discourse, the people at the top of this newly recognized mountain demand that it be taken seriously. They hold the rest of the world accountable to this new discourse, and they get impatient when the people around them don't immediately see the utter obviousness of the things that they can see from the top of this particular mountain. And if they have some political muscle, they usually start to flex it. It kind of reminds me of the story of the Tower of Babel, which I did an episode on about a year ago. But in this case, the languages being diversified are these discourses that have grown up in their online silo and suddenly burst onto the public scene. It's very much as if the people around us are suddenly speaking a different language. It actually reminds me of a meeting I went to with the Dragon Dads a few years ago. The Dragon Dads, in case you don't know, it's a group of fathers who want to love and support their LGBTQ kids. And since I have a few of those, I was invited. So we met in this restaurant one day, and a few of the dads had brought their children along. And when I say children, I mean that in the familial way, because these children were like in their late teens or early 20s. Anyway, the dads invited these visitors to stand and introduce themselves. And when they did, I suddenly saw a new discourse mountain rise up right in front of me. They were defining themselves using words I didn't know, and referring to social and sexual customs that I was unfamiliar with. It was interesting to watch myself as they talked, because the first thing that happened was that I got angry. I felt like a social and symbolic carpet had suddenly been pulled out from under me. I felt like, like I'd studied for a test and all the questions had gotten changed. What I really felt was that suddenly I was the old fogey. But after that initial flash, my rational mind kicked back in, and it wondered how I could have gotten so far behind. How had all this happened without me knowing? I mean, I've been publishing articles on LGBTQ issues in Sunstone for more than a decade. I've helped organize symposia where many of the presentations were on these subjects. And here I am, suddenly ignorant. These two young bucks are acting like it's something everybody knows. And despite my interest, despite my efforts, despite my experience, this new discourse had grown up without my knowledge. So, back during Joseph Smith's time, this diversifying of languages was definitely happening. At a much slower rate than it's going now, but still, plenty fast. But the people back then had one advantage. They could move. Indeed, that is what happened to the people at the Tower of Babel. They spread out across the land. And so, when one new discourse community got up enough steam and it couldn't coexist with its neighbors, it could pick up, like the Mormons, and head west. But we don't really have that option anymore. The best we can do is pick up and head to another Facebook group. And when it comes time to vote, we certainly find out how close together we live. Well, that's enough about partisan conflict. There was a lot of it during the Second Great Awakening, and there is way more of it now because of how quickly discourses can grow on the internet. So now let's talk about conspiracy shift. So, back while Joseph Smith was growing up, it was very much the norm to believe that invisible entities, both demonic and benign, were working behind the scenes all the time. The invisible world was as present and as potent as the physical world. This was why, when Joseph Smith would lead grown adults on treasure hunts at night, none of them would bat an eye when they would dig and dig without actually finding any treasure, because they knew that some spirit had whisked it away somewhere because they hadn't gone about their hunt correctly. So the world was a place of constant conspiracy, invisible beings conspiring either for or against the human race. I'm certainly going to concede that this worldview still exists in America today. But I'd also argue that there's way less of it now than there was then, simply because science and rationality have illuminated many of the dark corners that these invisible beings once inhabited. Some of us may still go looking for buried treasure, but it's pretty likely that we'll bring a metal detector along with us. We may give a sick person a blessing, but we still take them to the doctor. The invisible world has moved from being populated by beings to being populated by forces and laws. So Joseph Smith was very much a part of this invisible being worldview. But with the Book of Mormon, he was also part of a shift that has reached full blossom today. It's interesting, actually, when you think about it, to see how infrequently spirits show up in the Book of Mormon. The only spiritual being who really makes a grand appearance is Jesus to the brother of Jared, though the Holy Ghost does make a few promptings along the way, and there's an angel or two. But unlike the New Testament, where, you know, Jesus talks with and casts out various spirits, the Book of Mormon seems pretty bereft of them as characters, you know, actually making contributions to the story. So in the Book of Mormon, it's not spirits that are conspiring against humans. It's humans that are conspiring against each other. We have Kish Kooman and his band that try to infiltrate the government. We have the Gadianton robbers that hide in the wilderness and attack the population. We have Nephi uncovering a political assassination through revelation. It's not supernatural beings that finally destroy the Nephites. War takes care of that just fine. So as we get near the end of the Book of Mormon, we're not being warned about the evil spirits that surround us. Instead, we're being warned about secret combinations. And what that means is political conspiracy. And that has had a profound effect on the Mormon imagination. Certainly, there is still talk of evil spirits. But I bet that if you took a survey, most Mormons would say that they're much more worried about secret combinations than they are about evil spirits. Essentially, the Book of Mormon was part of a move away from an emphasis on spiritual conspiracy to political conspiracy. It was a move that certainly gained a lot of momentum when the Brighamites moved from Nauvoo to Salt Lake City, where they tried to set up their own kingdom, because, yes, the American government was indeed conspiring against them. So much so that the Brighamites finally had to give up polygamy in order to not be dismantled by the government, and finally become a part of America. And then, of course, the Utah Church started its century-long campaign, that's definitely still going, to become the perfect, upstanding Americans. We were so deep into that campaign that at mid-century, when Ezra Taft Benson focused his conference speeches on politics, connecting secret combinations with various political forces that he considered anti-American, he had a very attentive audience. He persuaded many Mormons that Satan expressed himself most dangerously through politics. He didn't ask you to believe that invisible beings were flying around causing the ills of the world. You just had to believe that there were flesh and blood human beings that were involved with massive secret combinations, which is quite an easy step for the modern Mormon mind to take. And of course, the Utah Church was not alone in making this shift. Most of America was headed in the same direction. There's this economic scholar named Robert Fogel who actually characterizes the late 1960s through the 1970s as a fourth Great Awakening, which saw the integration of church and politics in many other Christian denominations as well. In fact, I think it would be safe to say that you and I are part of that shift. I will admit that I believe politics and power are responsible for way more of the world's ills than invisible spirits are. But this shift is having one very interesting consequence. It's turning politics into religion. And I mean that literally, because we may have depopulated the spiritual world, but we haven't diminished our craving for worship. Now, when I say worship, I don't mean that we all have a craving to throw away our brains and follow blindly after a person or an idea. To me, worship means believing in concepts or people that give your life a sense of purpose. And I don't just mean, you know, a reason to give up in the morning. I mean something worth sacrificing for, something bigger than you, that you value more than yourself, something that makes you go above and beyond. So, the spiritual world has become much less emphasized, not just by the godless unbelievers, but by everybody. Even devoutly religious people have a smaller spiritual world now than they would have had 200 years ago. They focus more on the physical world. And the physical world has taken on a lot of the conspiracy thinking that used to run the religious world. Religious people are more likely to look to politics than to spirits to fix the ills of the world. And meanwhile, non-religious people still have the worship impulse. They still have the craving for something that gives their life a potent sense of purpose. And for both these groups, politics becomes the playing field of choice. But instead of religion defining the battleground between good and evil, instead of religion providing a vision of a glorious future, instead of religion defining morality, politics steps in. You may think I'm being metaphorical here, that I'm saying politics is like religion, but I really am being literal. Right now, politics is the space where our worship impulses are playing out. The funny thing is, politics gets the best of both worlds because it can harness the full power of the worship impulse of the non-religious and piggyback on the enthusiasm and the mythology of the religious. If you don't believe me, just look at Donaldism and its helpmeet, QAnon. Now, I know a lot of people who say that they approve of the policies Donald put into place, and I'm willing to believe them. But where does Donald's real power come from? I personally think it comes from his sincere belief that he is a god. And that in every practical aspect, he is a god. Think about it. He was born into opulence, and his place as a super wealthy and therefore super powerful individual has never been in question. For decades, his face has been on that great godmaker, television. And then he became president of the United States, and the entire world hung on his every tweet. For all intents and purposes, that is godlike power. And he used it. Casually. Multiple times a day. And as publicly as possible. And you could tell that he had an unquestioned belief that that power was rightfully his. And that he was the best person to wield it. He had no interest in political process. He had no interest in what other people thought. He could say, with no irony, "I am that I am." So, here we have a god. Next, we have his scriptures. Every budding religious movement creates scriptures using the tools that it has at hand. The tools that appeal to its audience. The Book of Mormon resonated with the ideas and the questions that were popular during the time, like the role of Native Americans in Christianity, the role of European Christian settlers in the Americas, and Joseph Smith translated this book that had multiple authors through divine means, but in the end, it was a book, which was the best medium at the time for spreading this kind of word. Now, fast forward to today. As we've already discussed, we live in a completely different information environment, with people who have completely different questions and concerns. How does a successful book of scripture get produced today? Partially through a process somewhat similar to the Book of Mormon's process, through revelation. According to the articles that I've been reading on the subject, and I'll definitely admit to not being any kind of expert on this, the body of QAnon writings has been fed into the world little by little through various message boards and groups, coming from a person who claims to have high-level knowledge of national and world political matters. The thing is, there's no way to check if the information this entity is doling out is really true. QAnon's perspective and access to the world is so high that it's, well, it's godlike. But here's where our contemporary context really changes things. Instead of having a single person, you know, a Joseph Smith, who receives these intelligence drops, as QAnon calls them, everyone has access to them. The ineffable words are available to all. Which is really exciting, because, you know, we're used to being on the tail end of any discourse we're a part of. We can maybe make a few changes to the footnotes, but the time when we could really help in developing the foundations of our discourse is long past. For example, I think it would have been great fun to be a Mormon during the Nauvoo period when the theology was being built. Now, you know, the most that we can really do is maybe add or subtract a sentence from the Handbook of Instructions. We're in maintenance mode rather than creative mode. But the QAnon people? They're on the ground floor. They're living during the Nauvoo period of their religion. And since they have access to all the revelations, and since they have access to all the information platforms, and since they don't need any kind of bona fides, everyone gets to have a hand in the creation of this new religion. For example, some of the predictions that QAnon has made haven't come to pass. But that's not a bug. It's a feature. It gives everyone the chance to be on the front line of reinterpreting the QAnon corpus. We can all be theologians now. In fact, I think we can push it one step further. And note that Donaldism and QAnon actually rely on not relying on evidence. They take entirely literally The idea that faith is the, quote, substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen, unquote. They had faith that Donald would win, and that faith provided the evidence of the things not seen, namely, evidence that there was mass voter fraud. It didn't matter that every institution we've created to define evidence detected no evidence of mass voter fraud. Faith was the constitutor of reality for them. Now, I need to point out that this isn't an extreme point of view. It's the point of view that I hear expressed regularly in LDS church meetings. Have faith, and you will see all evidence to the contrary overturned someday. Keep bearing your testimony until you believe it. Follow the prophet. And I'm also going to acknowledge that that approach is actually a social technology. If enough people believe a particular thing and work as if that thing is true, then that thing just naturally gathers gravity. It gathers momentum. And even if its foundations are absurd, which the foundations of most religions are, it won't matter. The belief in them gave them power. And we can see that happening now. No court found any evidence of massive voter fraud. But that doesn't matter. When the certification of the Electoral College came around, a huge number of Republicans voted to overturn the will of the voters on zero evidence. Only on the faith of the Donaldists. Faith really is power. And you really can't understate how exciting building this religion is, especially when it's such a small step from theologizing to engaging in holy war. I read in the Washington Post, it said, quote, QAnon believers in videos and posts about the siege said they felt invigorated by the starring role that they had played in battling their hero's enemies, unquote. And I can totally see why they'd feel that way. It's hard to find many opportunities for heroism in everyday American life. Our warrior selves usually just sit on a shelf gathering dust. I think that's one of the reasons why the Black Lives Matter demonstrations had such huge turnouts. We finally got to flex our warrior muscles in a high-stakes issue. So, way back at the beginning of this episode, I said that the siege of the Capitol made me say how weird it is to be a Mormon today. And now, I'm starting to understand what I meant. Basically, I was watching the same process that birthed Mormonism birthing another religion. And I realized that Mormonism is no longer a spring chicken. And, sadly, that we are no longer a peculiar people. The Donaldists and QAnon followers have that title all sewn up now. Rather than being a disruptor, which we were in our beginnings, Mormonism has become a defender of stable discourse, because now we're an integral part of that discourse. 150 years ago, we tried to escape the American discourse, and now we're committed to it. And we've put mammoth amounts of effort into maintaining our own discourse, which I think the general authorities are seeing slip away. As I mentioned in a previous episode, during the October 2020 General Conference, I definitely saw the general authorities backing off of invoking their authority in order to bring people into line. I think that was because they had seen the backlash that had occurred when they took a pro-face mask stance and realized that a great many of their conservative followers, who they previously thought that they could rely on to accept church authority, actually placed their political loyalties above their church loyalties. So, instead of hearing about unity in obedience, we heard about unity in diversity. It was quite a left turn. And, in case they'd forgotten how far their authority had slipped, The church leadership was reminded again when they posted their traditional congratulations to the winner of the presidential election, and their Facebook page exploded with fury from their right-wing members. I read through it. It was amazing. Toward the beginning of this episode, I referenced the Second Great Awakening. The various Great Awakening movements, some scholars say there have been four since colonial days, but all of these awakening movements were characterized by more established churches losing power and new churches springing up. But these new churches weren't springing up because they had better arguments or a sounder theology. In fact, they most often sprung simply out of the imagination of their founders. As I read on Wikipedia about the First Great Awakening, which took place during the 1730s and 1740s, in other words, 100 years before Joseph Smith, quote, opponents accused the revivals of fostering disorder and fanaticism within the churches by enabling uneducated, itinerant preachers and encouraging religious enthusiasm, unquote. But the other big things that happened during the various Great Awakenings were the beginnings of social reform movements, such as slavery abolition, women's suffrage, and, in the Fourth Great Awakening, gay rights and birth control issues. These same themes are showing themselves in spades today. Along with the fracturing of larger religious and political institutions, much of it erupting from uneducated premises and relying almost entirely on religious enthusiasm, we also have a huge growth in social reform groups. I found this interesting little tidbit in the New York Times. It says, quote, Tennessee pastor Greg Locke predicted not just a great awakening, but the greatest awakening that we have ever seen, unquote. If by greatest awakening Locke means affecting the most people, I would agree with him. But that word, awakening, it's starting to bug me. It kind of sounds like we're supposed to be finally engaging with reality instead of with mere dreams. But it seems to me that dreams are actually the thing that assert themselves most in any of these awakening periods. The dreams that the religious are basing their new churches on, and the dreams that social reformers are trying to achieve. So, I guess, welcome to the Fifth Great Awakening / dreaming. It doesn't seem to be a good thing or a bad thing. It seems to simply be a social dynamic cycling through yet again. One that's going to drain power from established institutions and siphon it over to new movements. It's basically the Tower of Babel all over again. Maybe instead of calling these periods Great Awakenings, we should call them Great Babelizations. It seems like a better description to me. Well, thanks for joining me for this week's episode of the Sunstone Podcast. Hopefully, you're also keeping up with the Sunstone Mormon History Podcast, the Deseret Drama Podcast, and the Sunstone Magazine Podcast, which you can find at patreon.com/sunstone. And if you have some new ideas brewing in your head about Mormonism, write them up and submit them to the Sunstone Summer Symposium, which is coming up in July. The deadline for proposals is the 1st of March. So head over to sunstone.org/calls-for-papers for more information. And while you're there, why not? Drop a few coins into our donation box at sunstone.org/donate to help us to continue to produce the content and the events that you enjoy. Thanks for all you do. We'll see you again next episode.